Welcome.
You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine on Sunday, February 23rd, 2025. My name is Bill McCann, and I'll begin with a featured article, the featured article on the magazine, The Comedian Looking for Something All of America Can Laugh About. Roy Wood Jr. performs in small clubs from Georgia to Wyoming, finding humor in the moments that leave us humbled and confused. It's a story by Ismail Muhammad. Partway through his latest special, Lonely Flowers, the comedian Roy Wood Jr. tells the story of the time he accidentally hired a white photographer, or as he corrects himself, he hired a photographer who he did not think would be white until he showed up. Whenever he travels to a city for a gig, he explains, artists who live there reach out to him to offer their services. He respects their hustle and sometimes accepts those offers, like the one he got from a guy who wanted to take some pictures of him. "Come on, take the pictures," Wood wrote back. "I'll see you next week, Dion." Wood drops Dion's name casually, letting the audience pick up on the joke before he has to explain it. As they start to lose it, Wood joins them in astonishment. Pitching his body forward, throwing his arms out, and bugging his eyes, he yells, "You see what I'm saying? I don't know no white Dions either. Never met one." Dion ends up being a bald, unimaginably chiseled military veteran with menacing tattoos consisting of an animal, a death threat, then a Bible verse decorating his arms. The kind of white man that a black person might not want to be left alone with. Wood is terrified of him. He makes sure to pay him up front, but he finds him unexpectedly sympathetic. It turns out that after returning from service abroad, Dion feels intensely isolated, and photography gives him a sense of purpose. On stage, Wood is unhurried, an amiable man, who, despite being 46, has the countenance of a church-going grandfather who still starches his Sunday suit. He's a master of the leisurely, even comforting story that plays to his audience's expectations of what is good, kind, and virtuous, only to foil those expectations with a well-timed word or a mischievous glance. When I first watched Lonely Flowers, I could feel this story about Dion teetering toward the saccharine. Maybe we can all get along, or at least get along better, if we just listen to one another. But then Wood lets us in on a disturbing detail. "I like the camera," Dion told him, "because, you know, I get to look down the crosshairs and still shoot people." Wood's look of earnest sympathy dissolves, and we're left wondering how to feel about Dion after all. Then the joke rounds yet another corner. Wood turns serious again, recalling how sincerely Dion thanked him in the green room, shaking his hand firmly and looking him right in the eye. "I was like, whoa," it says, his voice dropping to a stage whisper, seemingly humbled by the interaction. But then we reached the other side of his pause. He was about to kill some people. Wood imagines Dion at home, cleaning his rifle right up to the moment Wood contacts him. "We'll never know how many lives I saved," Wood says triumphantly, "because I took a chance on a white man." The story is typical of the special, a civic-minded cri de coeur of social atomization and the degradation of communal life in America, though it's a lot funnier than that makes it sound. Wood's complaint comes from a roguish sensibility that was shaped by his unique artistic trajectory. He got his start on the black Southern comedy circuit and eventually made his way onto Trevor Noah's iteration of The Daily Show, where he filtered contemporary social issues through his downbeat, absurdist logic. His humor now straddles those worlds, the bawdy, contrarian style of black comedy institutions like Comic View and Def Comedy Jam, with its love for life's vulgar, politically murky particulars, and the bien passant liberal comedy popularized by The Daily Show and its descendants. Though he became famous for his Daily Show work, the black vernacular is his bread and butter. You see it in the exaggerated physicality he adopts in the Dion story, the way he thrusts his head out and stares down the audience with an expression reminiscent of Bernie Mac, or in the distinctly Southern phrasing he'll adopt when playing one of his many characters. The cross-pollination yields a brand of comedy whose values are clear, but that never loses sight of life's unpredictability. Where so much of contemporary comedy is steeped in certainty, trading jokes for small points, Wood is interested in the moments that leave us humbled and confused. With Lonely Flowers, Wood is taking that sensibility to a national audience now mired in a politics of mutually assured destruction. He is wearied, but stays firm in the notion that his job isn't to badger and demean the half of the country that disagrees with him. He isn't necessarily hopeful. The special turns on a shouted refrain, "We ain't gonna take that." No. "We ain't gonna make it." There's an unspoken question at the special's heart, though. In the meantime, as we meander toward whatever it is that awaits us, how are we going to live together? In person, Wood is funny but sedate, speaking in a deadpan, carried along by a prankish undercurrent. Last fall, we met in Midtown Manhattan, where he was preparing to tape an episode of Have I Got News for You, a CNN political game show that he hosts alongside the comedians Amber Ruffin and Michael Ian Black. After makeup and a haircut, he ran downstairs for a late lunch before returning to his dressing room, where he strategized with writers about how to introduce the day's guest, the former Republican Illinois Congressman Adam Kinzinger. The problem was how to make Kinzinger's career trajectory following a vote to impeach Donald Trump. He resigned from the House of Representatives in 2021 rather than run for re-election. Funny. He's the former Republican congressman who once tried, he muttered before stopping, his voice rising into an exploratory vaudevillian shout, who once voted to impeach Trump. He lost his job and now he's stuck doing shows like this. Without pausing, he wondered if it was all right to wade into self-deprecating humor and search for the precise turn of phrase that might make the audience giggle rather than groan at a political tragedy. Have I Got News for You, an adaptation of a long-running British show, is Wood's first television project since he left The Daily Show in the fall of 2023. As a correspondent, he became beloved for his irreverent takes on the racial politics of the Black Lives Matter era. His set on the 2023 White House Correspondents' Dinner combined an earnest defense of journalists and their profession with piercing humor. After a joke falls flat, he quips that the reaction doesn't faze him. "I'm like Mitch McConnell, I ain't got no soul." The dinner created a groundswell of popular support, with critics and fans casting him as a favorite to succeed Noah on The Daily Show. But as the process dragged on and Comedy Central's intentions remained unclear, Wood was anxious that he would miss the window to have his own show. Wood was careful in speaking about why he left. "The Daily Show. That is the great inevitability of every job. Sooner or later you leave," Wood told me. Thinking about what's next after 8 years was not a premature thought. If he was going to secure another hosting gig, he decided he had to make his move before the 2024 presidential election got into full swing. Wood isn't one to let an opportunity slip through his fingers. "I ain't from the land of dreams," he told me this past fall. He was raised in Memphis, Tennessee and Birmingham, Alabama, and his father was Roy Wood Sr., a radio journalist pioneer who reported on black platoons in Vietnam, South African apartheid, and the civil rights movement for the black Chicago radio station WVON, before helping found the National Black Network, the first black-owned radio news service, where he was the news director. His mother, Joyce Dugan, was a respected teacher. Though his parents were highly regarded in the community, Wood's childhood was sometimes shaped by a sense of scarcity and limitation. We were raised by people who were fortunate to be able to vote, to drink from the same water fountain, Wood said. They were so exhausted from that battle that all they wanted was a house and a fair wage. The idea of dreaming beyond that was not commonplace, and in a lot of instances, it was frowned upon. In the South, you dare to dream beyond the horizon. His father's work presented one model for how Wood might dare to dream. When he enrolled at Florida A&M University in 1996, he decided he wanted to work in broadcast journalism, a major that required he take classes in public speaking. He discovered that every time he spoke in front of his classmates, he got laughs without even trying. Wood liked the feeling those laughs gave him, and he started studying the acts of comedians like Adele Givens, Sinbad, Chris Rock, and D.L. Hughley. George Carlin, he says, was canon for the fearlessness of his topics and concision with which he expressed opinions that audiences might otherwise find outre. I used to listen to You Are All Diseased once a week, listening to the wordplay and the inflections. It was just perfect. Then I would immediately throw on some Master P. In 1998, Wood was arrested for buying clothes with stolen credit cards and was suspended indefinitely from Florida A&M. This youthful indiscretion yielded an unexpected blessing. Wood still received the financial aid he would have used for his tuition, and that money, along with a job as a server at the buffet restaurant Golden Corral in Tallahassee, bankrolled his fledgling comedy career. He took buses across the South, sleeping in bus stations between gigs. When he returned to Birmingham to perform at an open mic at the Stardome, one of his mother's students saw him and told her about it. She was infuriated and insisted that he focus on getting back to school. Wood eventually did and even graduated, but he didn't quit stand-up. Instead, he drove out in a car his mother's mother bought to cities like Charlotte, sleeping in the passenger seat when he had to. Sometimes, when venues canceled on him, he would take day labor jobs on construction sites to pay for gas. Wood's style was molded by the difficulty of finding his voice in black clubs across the South. His own middle-class experience of blackness wasn't necessarily aligned with his audiences, and his early jokes, routines about the annoyance of a roommate eating your food, for example, didn't always land. Working those rooms taught him how to craft observational humor in a way that would resonate for everyone from older black professionals to gang members. But he also learned not to talk down to people. A black audience will go with you anywhere on any journey, he said, if you make it funny. He learned to embrace his off-kilter humor without condescending. That's what I know about, he said. I don't know about selling weed. That's not my experience. And my job as a comedian is to present to you my experience. And mine is a weird one. Eventually, he found himself in front of increasingly diverse audiences, too. One night, I'm performing for drug dealers. The next night, I'm performing for coal miners in eastern Kentucky. What are the unifiers? He recalled. His task, as he saw it, was to find the joke that would make both groups laugh. One of his best jokes from those days, he told me, was about being pulled over by the police and figuring out whether or not you're going to jail based on how long it takes for an officer to get back to you after he runs your ID. It was a perfect bit, he said, because it could unify the room. White people got friends that go to jail, he said, especially rednecks. Poor white people deal with the same stuff that black people do. Wood's focus on social issues was a natural outgrowth of that comedic approach which he hones to perfection in Lonely Flowers. Early on, he riffs on the absurdity of shopping at stores where it's impossible to find someone who works there. Only time you see an employee at the grocery store is when you do self-checkout wrong, he jokes before launching into a chorus of voices. The checkout machine telling you that you made a mistake. The tottering and elderly employee overseeing the checkout stations. The grocery store cashier who provides some of the only social interaction for lonely and unstable people. This morphs into a bit about pharmacies where everything is under lock and key and you have to fend off other customers after you find an employee to unlock all the merchandise. When you find an employee in the store, you got to hold their hand, he said, holding a phantom hand, strutting, warning off phantom rival suitors with a possessive stare. Wood's critique, the way technology has left us prone to dysfunctional loneliness, is trenchant, but his approach is fundamentally goofy. There's a strange way, too, in which the goofiness reinforces the melancholy at the heart of his joke, a yearning for an entire range of interactions that have fallen to the wayside in a world that doesn't have use for them. When I called Wood in late January, he was midway through a mini tour through Wyoming, Colorado, and Oklahoma, driving to 6 Air Force bases in 9 days. Before that, he attended the premiere of Love, Brooklyn, in which he has a supporting role, at the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. A few days after the mini-tour, he would visit his alma mater in Tallahassee and continue to New York to begin the new season, Have I Got News for You. I wondered why a comedian of his stature would submit himself to such a grueling run. It feels familiar. It keeps me grounded, he told me. Those trips remind him of his early life on the road when he would perform at the Comedy Zone in Ozark, a small town near an army base in southern Alabama. Those days put him in touch with the profound weirdness of America. In Ozark, he said, the town is troops and foreigners. Wherever you got deployed, you came home with a wife of that race. So it's one of the most diverse cities in Alabama. Asians, and Indians, and Arabs, and they all sound like they're from Alabama because they came over here, didn't speak English, and the English they learned was Alabama English. From Ozark, he would move on to audiences of college students at Fort Walton Beach, Florida, and retirees in Biloxi, Mississippi. And then Tuesday, I'm in Atlanta at Uptown with Earthquake and Nard Holston, two popular black comics, and a couple strippers in the club booing me. Contemporary comedy, he said, doesn't necessitate that kind of encounter. Social media, podcasting, and platforms like YouTube have changed the landscape, allowing comedians to target audiences that will be most responsive to their humor and make substantial money doing it. In a world where you can earn $500,000 off a podcast, he said, why would you go to Ozark for $150? For him, though, refining his act in front of all sorts of audiences grounds him in a specific ethos. I spent the first decade of my career meeting Americans where they were, figuring out what was important to them, and figuring out how to make those things funny, he told me. Every armpit, every factory town, every we used to make something here city, I've done it. So you start realizing that a lot of people are all individuals and to a degree most are harmless. People are only dangerous, he believes, when they allow their selfishness and ideological rigidity to blind them to the suffering of others. His touring feels like a shield against that selfishness, an investment in a connection with his fellow Americans. Now I'll read the Screenland section. How the Manosphere became mainstream entertainment. Dave Portnoy has long been vilified as a toxic guy. He's still the one millions follow for ordinary pizza review videos. This is a story by Willie Staley. Whenever Bill Belichick, the 72-year-old former head coach of the New England Patriots, goes out in public with his girlfriend, Jordan Hudson, who is exactly one-third his age, they tend to draw attention. It was no different at the 2025 NFL honors earlier this month. Everything about the red carpet photos accentuates their evil Knievel size age gap. Belichick looks sedately pleased in a maroon blazer, like a car dealer at a Shriners banquet. Hudson beams in a sparkly Cirque du Soleil-style number that covers approximately 12% of her torso. That's what most people seem to notice about the pictures. But not Dave Portnoy, the founder and owner of Barstool Sports, the Utney reader for the light domestic swilling, back-slapping, zin-packing, parlay-chasing American male. Portnoy has long been treated as an avatar for everything that elite media is not. Barstool might be considered the outermost ring of the so-called manosphere, the vast realm of male-oriented alternative media that has been credited with the rightward drift of the young male vote. Portnoy, a Trump supporter with a long history of misogynistic comments and bullying, who has been accused of non-consensually filming women during uncomfortably rough sex, doesn't exactly run away from that label. He's denied the claims about sexual misconduct and filed a suit against the outlet that published them. It was dismissed. And what he noticed about the photos of Belichick and Hudson was the clutch Hudson wore, which was shaped like a little football. Very cool purse from BB's girlfriend, he posted on X. Football girlfriend purse. It's certainly possible that Portnoy, a diehard Patriots fan, was being ironic, conveying something like, I refuse to see anything unusual here. But I bet that he genuinely did like the purse. I would make that bet because I've spent many hours watching Portnoy's most fascinating non-sports media product, his One Bite pizza reviews. And I know about his softer side. He's been doing these reviews for 12 years, though I first encountered them during the pandemic. I was, at that point, ambiently aware of Portnoy, but only for all the stuff people hated about his website. The smoke show of the day photos, the army of online stoolies who mobbed his many critics. But if you watch the pizza videos, you're reminded that most of the stuff these controversial media figures do is entirely normal. A lot of the time, it's downright amusing. Each episode of One Bite begins with Portnoy's walking out the door of the business under consideration, then executing the entirety of his review right out front, sometimes practically blocking foot traffic, often with the proprietor looking on anxiously. Given all this, the concept seems almost cruel. He buys an entire pie, but reviews the pie based on one bite. One bite goes the motto. Everybody knows the rules. The reason for this, Portnoy explained in an early video, is that the response has to be immediate, beneath the level of consciousness, like a Rochblock test. But Portnoy can never limit himself to one bite. typically finishing about half of a slice of molten pizza, blowing big cheekfuls of air on it the way you would for a toddler, balancing the rest of the pie in his other hand as he tries to sort out where it belongs on his 10-point scale. Portnoy likes pizza with char on the bottom, pizza that doesn't flop when you hold it by the crust. He seems to have an almost childish distaste for strong flavors like oregano and parmesan. Vinyl signs, old photos on the wall, wood paneling. He's a sucker for the dumpy vernacular forms of the northeastern corner joint, and he visibly struggles when a mom-and-pop shop with a charmingly old-school interior has a mediocre product. He agonizes over his scores, always insisting on their decimal places, which give them the absurd specificity of that other famous user of the decimalized 10-point scale, Pitchfork. This is just one of the many details. His love of garish vintage clothing, his fetish for authenticity, the yelpiness of this highbrow foodie quest that eventually made me realize if Portnoy were doing this 15 years ago, you might reasonably have assumed he was some kind of hipster, not an avatar of a reactionary jock fringe. In fact, there was something like this back then, a viral blog called Slice Harvester by a New York punk rocker that eventually became a memoir published by Simon & Schuster and deemed one of NPR's best books of 2015. Once you accept this, you can see Portnoy more clearly. The Portnoy in the pizza videos often has a preening, fussy, almost effete quality that complicates his butch self-image. He frets over his weight when he's been doing too many reviews. He shows off his tan when he's in Florida. When someone walks by with a dog, he speaks to it in that baby voice people sometimes do and tries to guess its name. This can't seriously be part of the fearsome manosphere, can it? If it is, if Portnoy's website and personal conduct put anything he touches in some marginal category outside the bounds of mainstream decency, then his many, many fans have not gotten the message. In the videos, Portnoy's frame warps reality around him. People yell from passing cars, crowds form, smartphones deploy, mothers hand over babies. If the media business is about reaching people, then these people have been well and truly reached, and not by the mainstream, but also not by political propaganda or anything with any overt ideological content whatsoever. They've been reached by pizza review videos. This is a common dynamic when the mainstream media considers the manosphere. Joe Rogan, arguably the biggest of its boogeymen, makes headlines when he transgresses some norm or another, but often he just talks about DMT, aliens, and MMA fighting at excruciating length. Over the past decade or so, the media has devoted a lot of energy to the purging of toxic elements, the presumption being that we would remain in control of what happened afterward. I suppose we imagine we were digging out some place for all these unwanted energies to go, some cesspool far from our fort. But after some years, the cesspool got bigger, and our fort got smaller, and eventually the cesspool must have looked inviting. Because look at it now. People are swimming in it, tanning on its shores, doing donuts in it on their sea-doos, probably mystified by any claims that it's a cesspool. In fact, looking over at our sad little fort, they probably enjoy whatever scum remains. That's the thing. It's not as if Portnoy isn't a jerk. His reputation seems well-earned. But the pizza videos show that people still yearn for that trace of meanness, that disregard for niceties, that implicit demonstration of a brutal capacity for honesty. In a video from last year, Portnoy visited a family in Troy, New York, whom he had come to know for tragic reasons. Their son Derek, who suffered from a form of muscular dystrophy, was a big Barstool fan. When he was in hospice care, his older brother arranged a birthday FaceTime call with Portnoy. On that call, Portnoy promised that he would review the family's homemade pizza the next time he was in the area. He made good on that months after Derek died. In the video, the family offers him a drink and shows him around their home. The sidewalk they laid out in the backyard for Derek's wheelchair, the bench they made him in his honor. Portnoy signs Derek's Barstool flag, still hanging in his room. And Portnoy visits the family's kitchen, where Derek's father cooks pizza using a conventional oven and not the outdoor setup Portnoy imagined, a detail Portnoy fixates on, clearly troubled. "Listen, how truthful do you want me to be here?" he asks after a bite. The family says Derek would have wanted his unvarnished opinion. Portnoy gives it a 5.8, temporarily stunning the family into silence. That is, until they start laughing. Willie Staley, the writer, is a story editor for the magazine. He has previously written about the business of streaming television, the end of Twitter, and The Sopranos. Now I'll read a letter of recommendation. London's most despised thoroughfare is actually kind of great. Euston Road, E-U-S-T-O-N. Euston Road hosts the site of the longest champagne bar in Europe, 5 pret-a-managers, and a phenomenal ER that I recommend to anyone considering breaking a bone. It's an article by Francesca Carrington. Euston Road isn't the kind of place Londoners go on purpose. It's a wretched 6-lane thoroughfare between King's Cross and Great Portland Street, high both in levels of air pollution and in the number of people in a traffic-induced tiz. It's a place you suffer through on your way to somewhere more pleasant. "Meet you on Euston Road," said nobody, ever. 100 years ago, the English critic and journalist Sidney Dark called Euston Road the most depressing thoroughfare in central London, noting the 3 train stations among its dismal landmarks. He wrote, 100 years ago, the position of these stations is evidence of the Englishman's queer habit of showing his worst side to the world. I can imagine a stranger arriving at Euston Station, walking out into Euston Road, claiming, "So this is London," and immediately going home again. I used to hate it too. I've missed trains and been late for work and even my godson's baptism because of that road. When I got my first car in the summer of 2020 and started driving with my sister from London to my parents' house, we used to make bets on how long it would take us to get down what we called the Euston Road. 20 minutes was about standard for the mile-long stretch. As we treacled along in my little Yaris, I would track landmarks to measure our progress. The tangle of bikes outside the British Library, what used to be a squat cider bar outside Euston Station, the first Premier Inn, the second Premier Inn. It wasn't long before I realized that I actually looked forward to these sights, even needed them. I was stuck in a traffic jam, and if I wanted entertainment, I'd better start looking out the window. Soon I was noticing the patterns and novelties of the road with fondness. I guessed who the Parisians fresh off the Eurostar might be. I liked logging the color of today's supercars beneath the rosy Gothic spindles of the St. Pancras Pancras Hotel. I marveled at how this ecstatic George Gilbert Scott edifice shared space with gray tower blocks, as well as shops and cafes anonymous in their garishness. Together, these buildings trace the contours of change in the city, its history jumbled out of order on a slightly shabby street. And there, paying no mind to any of it, are the hundreds of bodies jostling against one another as they get to wherever it is they're going. But they should, for Houston Road is in fact the most generous of thoroughfares. It's the site of the longest champagne bar in Europe. Five pret-a-managers, and a phenomenal ER that I recommend to anyone considering breaking a bone. On one end is an unpopular underpass where someone has left belongings tucked into a polluted corridor of cars for safety. On the other, taxis disgorge well-heeled visitors on the doorstep of the retro Standard Hotel. Opposite is the fat and welcoming British Library, composed of 10 million bricks, a number that merely nips at the toes of the 60 million brick St. Pancras Hotel next door. Best of all are the caryatids of the St. Pancras New Church. Four toga-wearing terracotta ladies who bear part of the roof, austerely holding the gaze of passengers on the top level of the number 30 bus. When I pass Euston Station, London's mid-century commuter hell answer to Penn Station, I sometimes think about how in 2021, activists protesting a new high-speed train line burrowed tunnels beneath it. I read in a news article at the time that one of them was called Jimbino Vegan, a name that dogged my thoughts until I remembered that a barefoot busker in a park handed me a flyer with that same name on it in the weeks before the dig. Or I think about one night when the street was thronged with carousing Scots, some in kilts, most of them singing, who came to London for a soccer match. I loved the idea that these men took the train all the way down from Scotland to King's Cross and decided that the constellation of cruddy pubs a few meters away from the station was a reasonable place to end their journey. Dumb reminiscences like these speak to the way our lives puddle into the architecture of a city, the way we sketch buildings and paving stones and traffic intersections with our memories, the way places become ours when we compile little facts and stories about them. The house that used to be over there, a person you once saw and can't forget. I want to say there's nowhere like Euston Road. I feel confident that in no other city has the site of something called the Great Dust Heap been replaced by an ancient unmarked stone and a betting shop with tinted windows. But all cities have streets that vibrate similarly with life and mess and history. Euston and the dirty, busy, lived-in streets like it are marvelous because they're where our experience of a place collides with what's already there. Isn't that why we live in cities in the first place? To feel our existence rubbing up against everyone else's? At least, that's how I feel now whenever I return to London. I shuttle from an overstuffed plane to an overstuffed rush hour tube from Heathrow, and when I get off dog-tired at King's Cross, it isn't to space or calm or anything remotely people-free. I walk onto Euston Road. I take in the cranes, the cabs, the ladbrokers, the high arches set in the honeyed stone of the station, and that weathered, inscrutable stone across the road, and I know that I'm home. Francesca Carrington is a writer from London based in Brooklyn. Her writing has appeared in The Guardian, the FT magazine, and Tatler, among other publications. And shut it down. There's been a technological glitch, and so I'm unable to complete this, but thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine, and I'll get it fixed by next week.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. Cerebral Entanglements: How the Brain Shapes Our Public and Private Lives. The author is Alan J. Hamilton. The book cover has five rows of three brain scan images depicted in various pastel colors. The reviewer is Deborah Bloom. Can understanding the brain make us better people? In Cerebral Entanglements, Alan J. Hamilton argues that new imaging technologies give us unprecedented access with revolutionary implications. There is a photograph of a sculpture of a brain made of rose-colored fibers. The caption reads, "New imaging technologies," writes Alan J. Hamilton, "may make us the first generation able to image and quantify human thought." The human brain, it's amazing. A master conductor of our emotional symphonies, a supercomputer of intelligence, a treasure inside the temple of the skull, where it gloriously shimmers, vivid, vital, jewel-like. I mean, is it any wonder we're such a special species? Sorry, I had to get that out of my system. Books built on hyperbole seem to bring out the worst in me, and Cerebral Entanglements, a new book by the surgeon and medical consultant Alan J. Hamilton, is so breathlessly excited about our brains and how they work, about the dazzle of new insights and technologies, that occasionally this reader felt compelled to take a break and fan herself. On the other hand, if you're the kind of person who enjoys hearing the brain described as the holy of holies, the chemistry of human relationships as finding treasure on the map of love, and happiness as a good wine, then disregard my reaction. Obviously, I'm not that kind of person. Still, in the interest of fairness, I'll also tell you that Hamilton's tour of all things brain does have its charms and virtues. A friendly writing style, a core of moral decency, and a wide-ranging wealth of research to back up his points. Cerebral entanglement sprawls across many different fields that investigate how we, and our busy brains, engage with the world, neuroscience, endocrinology, history, culture, psychology, moral philosophy. Well, you get the idea. New technologies allow us to visually illuminate the brain as it encounters myriad issues and challenges. This means, Hamilton argues, that we are the first generation to be able to image and quantify human thought, an idea to justify some exuberance, you might say, and in the 300-odd pages of his book, he does his best not to miss a single thought of importance. Of this bounty, I particularly liked his compassionate exploration of the way children's brains are altered by trauma and neglect. Hamilton underlines the impact of such experiences by citing studies which show a negative effect even on fetal development if a pregnant woman is exposed to violence. There's an insightful look at what brain imaging and neurochemistry research has shown us about how grief, loss, and depression can reshape the brain, changing both its physical structure and chemical function. The book includes a series of functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, depictions of the brain as it responds to situations ranging from stress to injury. These are fascinating and powerful. I studied and restudied one of a patient suffering from PTSD. The image read as a bomb on a timer, lit by brain regions sparking with fear and rage. But despite such examples, or as Hamilton puts it, such heady stuff, I did not find myself swept away by his assurance that we are now drivers at the wheel of the brain car, so to speak. When he writes, "The brain is the master editor of reality," I'm not sure exactly what he means. Similarly, when he proposes that imaging technology now allows us to see wisdom's shape and form, it's unclear to me that we've learned how to define wisdom, to see it clearly, or even to practice it in a meaningful way. Although Hamilton is prone to such sweeping statements, he also occasionally admits some limits. In a section on the subconscious, he acknowledges that the brain rarely works the way we think it does or should. Later, while examining the mind-body connection, he writes, "We think we have sound logical explanations about the way the brain should be organized, but we are almost always wrong." Yes, the human brain is beautiful, remarkable, and powerful. And it's true that researchers have brought us closer than ever to mapping its structure, deciphering the chemistry and electrical signals that zing through our nervous systems, helping us better understand what drives human behaviors at their best and worst. But the brain has yet to yield all of its mysteries. In his conclusion, Hamilton expresses the hope we can use our hard-acquired knowledge of the human self to reinforce our more compassionate behaviors and possibly bring more kindness to a world that desperately needs it. This reviewer, cranky as she may be, hopes for the same. The reviewer, Deborah Blum, is the director of the Knight Science Journalism Program at MIT and the author of The Poison Squad, One Chemist's Single-Minded Quest for Food Safety at the Turn of the 20th Century. The following is a review of the Paddington Bear films based on Thomas Michael Bond's book series. The reviewer is Rachel Sherman. Grieving with Paddington. A newly mourning daughter finds an unexpected companion in the beloved films whose star, a little bear, sets an example of how to live with loss. There's a picture that depicts Paddington Bear wearing only his iconic red hat and a tag on a string hanging around his neck. He is looking at the camera with an enigmatic look in what looks like perhaps a train station. It was on the flight home from my father's funeral that I first met Paddington. In search of an easy watch to take our minds off things, my partner David and I thought a movie about the adventures of a CGI bear in a floppy red hat might do the trick. We went in cold, neither of us having grown up with the children's books. If you're familiar with the story, you'll know this was a naive, if not poor, decision in a time of grief. Almost immediately, Paddington, already an orphan, loses his uncle Pastuzo in a cataclysmic earthquake in Peru. Soon after, his Aunt Lucy tells him that he must find a new home, alone, without her. Orphaned doubly in the first 10 minutes, I began to cry. Since I was a child, I had been consumed with my father's needs and longed not to be the parent to my parent. Poor Paddington, forced to navigate the world of adults. The Paddington films have acted as a strange benchmark. At 31, I watched the first movie the day after laying my father to rest in a pine box, and the sequel, which was pure delight and offered a reprieve from the darkness of mourning, a few months later. By the time Paddington in Peru, the third movie, is released on February 14th in the United States, it will be nearly 2 years since my father passed. The series has become an unexpected grief tracker. Paddington, my fortuitous companion. My father and I had at best a complicated relationship, as he had with just about everyone. An addict with more than a few mental health disorders and later dementia, he'd burn bridges with anyone who tried to offer that fleeting, suffocating thing called help. There were years of unemployment, stints in rehab, bouts of disappearances, and countless emergency room visits. I thought I had pre-grieved, to borrow a term from Roman Roy, so the ripples of hopelessness and thoughts of what's the point of it all that followed his death arrived as a sick aftershock. I was emptied. On the plane, as I watched this innocent little bear, with his unshakable optimism and impeccable manners, experience loss after loss, that emptiness grew until it blackened the whole of me from the inside out. I'd been tricked by a children's film. David reached out to hold my hand. Aunt Lucy tells Paddington that he must go to London, the birthplace of an explorer she and Uncle Pastuzo once hosted. She places a luggage tag around Paddington's neck that says, "Please take care of this bear." I winced, wishing someone would do the same for me. But Paddington protests. He doesn't know anyone in London. "There was once a war in the explorer's country," Aunt Lucy gently explains. "Thousands of children were sent away for safety, left at railway stations with tags around their necks, and unknown families took them in and loved them like their own." This time, I wasn't the only one trying to hold it together. David, a grandson of two Holocaust survivors, turned to me, and we erupted in sobs. We paused the film and leaned our foreheads together, weeping, letting our shoulders rattle the tray tables as we convulsed. David's paternal grandmother, his Safta, Frieda Schindling, escaped the war in 1939 via the Kinder Transport, the rescue operation that brought nearly 10,000 children from Nazi-occupied Europe to England. Frieda, 14, boarded a train alone, leaving behind her parents and older sister. All were killed in the concentration camps.